This is the Heartland Collegiate Compendium. Principles of Microeconomics, Econ 10104. Lecture 8, delivered on the 12th of February of 2009. The title of this lecture is Global Trade and Trade Policy.
Today, Global Trade and Trade Policy. I begin, however, by stepping back and bringing up one last subject that has to do with choice in markets. And here I'm going to talk to you a little bit about what might seem to be not part of the subject matter. I'm going to talk about the idea of property rights. Because when I draw the supply and demand curves, it's so easy for me to just simply draw them and say, there's your damn demand curve, there's your supply curve, now learn it, my God. But there's so much going on behind it. And I'm not talking about that utility theory stuff. Yeah, that's really behind it too, and that's really complicated stuff. But there's something else that is going on behind supply curves and behind demand curves. When I draw these things, here we go. Here is a quantity price axis, and here is a quantity price axis. I'm going to draw on the first one, here on the left, a demand curve, just a downward sloping line, nothing to be afraid of here. And here is a supply curve, again, this one is upward sloping, and again, nothing to be afraid of there either. But here's the thing, there's something kind of odd hiding underneath a demand curve. A demand curve represents a locus of points where representing people's willingness and ability to demand a quantity of the product at different prices. So you would have at this very high price, like we can look at a very high price and a very low price, and at this very low price, we would say at price 1, we would have a quantity demanded of 1, and then at a price 2 much higher, we'd have a much lower quantity demanded, QD2. But you see, there's something important about that that's more than just drawing a pretty graph that Mom could put up on the refrigerator. Clearly, the dominant effect here is the substitution effect, although there is an income effect as well. The dominant effect in microeconomics is the substitution effect. As the price of a product rises, people will demand a lesser quantity of it because the price relative of substitutes has now decreased. We can go move to other products. We can get other things. But therein lies the important idea. We can. We can choose not to. We can choose to. But we are allowed to. It's not even a point of allowed to. We are free to choose what to do here. If the price goes up, we can say, oh, well, I'll buy it anyway because I like it. Or we can say, screw that. I'm going to buy something else that is lower in price. I have that freedom of choice. It is a choice that is mine to do. It belongs to me as part of a free society, and in this case, as part of a free market. A free market permits me to say no. There is not a government that says you will buy this. Unfortunately, it's getting less and less that way in some regards, but at least in the free market theory, and at least in some products still, we can walk away if we choose to. When the price goes up, we can move to other products. We are free to do that. Now, on the supply side, when the price of a product rises from P1 to P2, by the law of supply, the quantity supply rises from QS1 to QS2. The quantity supplied is rising. And again, it's not the supply rising, it's the quantity supplied rising. But the reason that is happening is that as the price of this product rises, the owners of the firm, with the help of the management, oftentimes through the activities of the management, can move their factors of production away from other products, which have now become more costly in terms of opportunity costs if they are doing something else, and we can move them and reallocate them toward this product. The owners are free to rearrange their capital and their physical capital, their human capital, their land, and all of that to this product. They can move toward it because the price signal is telling them that they are wasting their resources by doing something else with their factories of production, so they are free to move toward this product. There is no central planning committee, Politburo, King, ancient scribal laws that tell them what they must produce. They can choose to produce this product or not produce it. And if it becomes if the price of it goes up, they can respond to that market signal by shifting their factors of production away from other things that they were doing toward this, where they can make more money. And that is, again, a representation of the power of a free market. You see, and underneath this, there is the concept of the property rights. In terms of the supply curve, the supplier has the right to make a profit, to use his or her entrepreneurial skill as he or she chooses. Those who provide those factors of production have that property right of theirs. The owners of the land have the right to sell it or not to sell it. The owners of the capital have the right to sell it or not to sell it, rent it or not to rent it. And the workers have the right to rent their services at the prevailing wage that the firm is offering or not. On this side, you have the fundamental right to make the choice. Your property is yours. And in this way, and let me ask you a little quick test question here, Q. When I draw a demand curve and a supply curve on the same quantity price space, what is that called? You remember what that's called? Yes, it's a market. That's a market. Here, the market is going to find an equilibrium, that point where the supply and the demand meet each other. And that price, that equilibrium price, is where the quantity being demanded by the market at that price clears the quantity supplied off the shelves at that same price. And that all comes back to that idea of the freedom of the choice of the participants in the market. You are free to choose to participate. You're free to choose not to. But you see, in this kind of a market, it is absolutely essential that you have your property rights and I have mine. What's yours is yours and what's mine is mine. And if there is going to be a trade, it would have to be the case that it's beneficial to both of us. We won't have a trade if what's yours is yours and you don't want to trade with me. But if it's a completely free market, what's mine is mine, and I would give it up only if it was of benefit to me to do so in trade with you. And you would be the same. Later in this course, you'll hear a fancy term for this. We'll say that in free markets, only Pareto superior moves would be made. And we'll go back to that. Free markets would not compel people to do what is against their interest. You might not like all of the agreement that happens with making a trade, but you're not going to make it if it doesn't benefit you more than it hurts you. Clearly, there has to be that fundamental sense of property rights. You will not rent me your land unless it is to your benefit. I will want to rent your land if it is not to my benefit. If the market exists, it exists in transactional form only because we both have gotten something better out of it than we were before we traded. You follow that? It's kind of a subtle piece of logic here. But it all hinges on what's mine is mine, what's yours is yours. That's not a communist system at all, where the state owns everything and then it provides everything in a capitalist system. The state does not own everything. We do. You own your property, your land. You own your labor. You own your body. And the government can't tell us what to do with it. We make the choices based upon our assessment of whether we'll be better off in the trade or without the trade. You follow what I'm saying here? Good. Now, let me come up here and talk about this for a minute. Look. That equilibrium point there, that equilibrium price, is more than just a point in space. There's a whole lot more going on behind the scenes here. You see, there are a lot of other people in this market. Look at this right here. Now, there is a place where there are consumers who would be willing and able to pay a higher price to get some of this product. They don't have to. They have to pay the prevailing equilibrium price, which is less. Let me make this real for you, sir. I want you to look at this place, and we're going to blow this place up, okay? We're going to make a big magnification of it, okay? See that? That's your ass. That point right there. You would have paid a lot more for water. You don't have to pay more. Wouldn't you? If you were thirsty, you'd pay a bunch for water. You don't have to. In fact, we see that all the time. People who buy these bottles of water, they're paying $1, $2 for a bottle of water that some fool just ran a spigot. Yeah, there's stuff in there. And then you close up and then you'll buy it. I paid $2 for this water. Uh-huh. You could have bought that water out of your own sink for less than a penny. Same water, too. And probably someone didn't sneeze in it before they closed the cap. You see, there's the thing, though, is you'll pay more for a lot of things. Think about this. Okay. If you had this come to school naked, would you pay a lot for a good amount? Certainly. I mean, what did you pay for that shirt? Like 50 cents at Salvation? Oh, I'm sorry. That's harsh. You'd pay like $20 to get a pair of shorts on so you didn't have to run around al dente. See, that's nasty. I wish I hadn't even visualized that. Damn. You would pay to cover your nudity. You would pay more than you pay. Wouldn't you be willing to pay for some oxygen if all of a sudden a black hole sucked all the oxygen out of the atmosphere? Oh, you'd pay for some. Uh-huh. Think about it this way. Here's one. Imagine you are 50 years old. And you've never had sex. Well, wouldn't you pay for some? Yeah. Yeah, you would. Don't give me that. Yeah. Sure. The right bar at 2 o'clock when your eyes are bad. Yeah, you could get some for free. But you would also pay a lot for it too. Look at what Elliot Spitzer did. Look what John Edwards did. Mm. He paid with his political life. But you see, we will pay for a lot more for things than we have to. Free markets give a great deal of consumer surplus. And that's what this whole area right here, from equilibrium up to the demand line, is. It's called consumer surplus. All of this right through here, this represents the total value of what people would pay that they don't have to pay. All those people would pay more for a product than they ever would will have to. That's consumer surplus. And it is huge in a capitalist economy. Now, let me show you something else here. Here's the other side of this story. Look at this low price right here. See this price? I drew the supply curve down there, which means that I am making the representation that suppliers existed down there at low prices. See this guy right here, or this group of businesses right in here? They would have charged you less for the product. They would have been willing to deliver at least a little bit to the market at a much lower price. They don't have to. They can charge a higher price because people will bear it. The equilibrium price is above that, so they will be able to charge more than they were, than was necessary for them to deliver their product to the market. Now look at all of these companies in here. This area from the equilibrium price down to the supply curve is called producer surplus. And that red area of consumer surplus and that blue area of producer surplus together represent total market surplus. And I can assure you, I could show you the math of it in a little more advanced math class. I could show you that when we have the division of the supply and demand bifurcated by the equilibrium price line, this area is larger than it would be in any other configuration whatsoever. Markets that are free are the ones that provide the largest producer and consumer surplus in total. Later in the course, you'll see that a monopoly actually operates in such a way that it makes the total surplus less, which is an indication, as far as public policy goes, that monopolies are one of those places where it is better to intervene if you want to increase the total surplus, the producer and the consumer surplus. And that's why it's a tragedy that we have sat back on our fat asses and let these monopolies just go bananas. Microsoft, the oligopoly of the telecoms, the outrage of Google taking over the information universe. And we just sit there, well, that's a free market operating. No, it's not. That's not what creates a free market. I want to stop here for 1 second and bring up something about producers to you before I go any further in this course. And I was just imagining it, but I got a couple of looks on people's faces when I said the company could charge a lower price, but it doesn't have to. It can charge up to the maximum. You'd say, well, yeah, they charge a lower price. Let me show you something here. I'm going to just set up a scenario. Who looks? Unfortunately, you look perfect for this role. Your name is Cecil, and you own Cecil's Gas Station. Now, as Cecil in Cecil's Gas Station, you wear the obligatory shirt with the oval that says Cecil. Your pants are down so that your butt crack shows when you squat over to look under the lady's the car. The lady asks you to see what the noise is. You find out it's a dog. She had been wondering where it was for years, and it was under there, caught in the manifold. You're Cecil, and Cecil, you run a gas station. And Cecil, you have just bought your last load of gas. You bought 20,000 gallons of gas at $2 per gallon. Okay? Now, what you do is you mark that gasoline up, let's say, 25 cents a gallon to sell it to the public. So, you're running your station at $2.25 a gallon. And you look out at the stations around you, which purchase their gas in essentially the same distributor markets. Well, I mean, maybe from different distributors, but they're all about the same. And you see the prices of everyone else are around $2.25. Matter of fact, some of your competitors might call you, say, I'm going to $2.25 today. Where are you? And you say, yeah, $2.25 sounds good. Now, that's not collusion, really. There are many stories, well, they all collude. They call each other. Well, so what? They could walk out and look at each other's damn signs. That's not collusion if you call. Gas station owners actually used to call each other. They do it a little bit now. I'm going up 25 cents, or I'm going up 10 cents, or I'm going down 5 cents. There's nothing collusive about that because they could look out their window and see it anyway on each other. Okay, you are charging $2.25. Now, you've just finished, the truck is pulled out, and you go back in, you're hitching up your pants because they're almost down, and you kind of go back and you sit down in your store, and you got your little black and white TV with the rabbit ears on it, and you sit down to just watch the news. There was just a military incident between the United States and Iran. Iran has mined the Strait of Hormuz. The price of oil on the high seas is about to skyrocket. Futures prices of oil have gone through the friggin' roof. Your next load of gasoline is going to cost you $10 a gallon. You look out, and there all of your competitors have already gone to $10.25 a gallon. What are you going to do? Stay at $2.25 or go to $10.25? You got your choice, one or the other. What is it?
Stay.
What happens when you have to buy your next load of gasoline? You're done. You're gone. You're gone. You can't buy your next load of gasoline because you're pricing on historical cost instead of replacement cost. You see that? It's not greed. Well, greed might, you know, we can attribute it to greed, sure. But if you do not bring your price up to the prevailing level that everyone else is, you're going to put your gas at $2.25. You're going to leave it there. Every mofo in town is going to come to your station and suck your gasoline tanks dry. And you know what they're going to do after they finish sucking your gas tanks dry? Sure they will. And they won't even remember your sorry ass. Because as mean and cruel as you can be as a businessman, consumers are just as fickle as hell. They'll just go on to the next place. Maybe they'll say, yeah, I remember Cecil. Boy, did he have a pretty crack. But other than that, they're not going to care. Do you understand that idea there? Yeah, we price it prevailing. We're not stupid enough to price below prevailing because the replacement cost could destroy our business. If we do not move with what we expect the next load to cost us, we're going to be creamed. You will see this much more powerfully in macroeconomics. It's not the historical cost. It's not the average of costs that you've had that matters. What matters is what you expect the next cost to be. If you don't do it that way, you are dead as a business person. You have to look to the future. Past is done. It is gone. It is a Kodak moment. And Kodak doesn't even make film cameras very much anymore. I don't mean to be really harsh about that, but that's actually a very important point. Let me take this off the board now. Okay? And that, by the way, goes back to that idea of marginals, the last or the next. And it also goes to the heart of economics, which has to do with expectations. Let me get this off the board here, and I'm going to erase this stuff. Now, that's all I have to say about consumer and producer surplus, and I would certainly not ask you any deeply complicated questions about it on an exam. I would want you to see where the consumer surplus was and where the producer surplus was. And I would also want you to keep this in mind, because when I get to the theory of the firm, industries that are in monopoly, in a monopoly configuration, that producer surplus and that consumer surplus come back again, and I show you the whole thing over again and show you how dramatically different that red and blue area look under monopoly as opposed to competition. It's quite surprising. Also, and the book addresses this, although I don't beat it over the head so much, taxes can also take away surplus area simply because they deprive the market of its efficient pricing of products. And so to the extent that consumers eat a tax, consumer surplus is taken away by a tax. To the extent that the suppliers would be the ones who would eat the tax, then it would be the producers who would suffer a loss of surplus under a tax. Now, that gets into stuff, and we'll get back to that here in a little bit, in a couple of lectures. But for the time being, let me move on to global trade. And the point that I'm going to make here is just one thing. I'm going to do one thing and one thing only in the last half hour of this lecture. But the funny thing is, this has implications in all kinds of subjects other than just pure economics, microeconomics, macroeconomics. At the university, I want to bring up the same concept in business classes, especially when I'm talking about management and managerial performance and human resources. And I really can't do it because I can't assume that all the students have had their economics classes. And even if they have, I can't assume that they had this point emphasized to them sufficiently. So in a way, when I'm going to mention the management side of it, you'll get it far more than they would when I'm talk about this, the implications of what I'm going to show you here. Now, let me do it this way. I'm just going to set up an example and use that as my way of defining a couple of terms. Suppose that we are in a world of two countries. We'll have a country A here, and we'll have a country B here. And I'll write those across a row. Now, down the column, I'm going to say, all right, these two countries can each produce two products. They can produce steel, and they can produce corn. Now, we're going to look at the endpoints, where they allocate all the resources to each of them, allocates all of its resources to one or the other. So here we go with this thing. Suppose that in country A, if it allocated all of its resources to steel, it could produce 1,200 tons of steel. Now, on the other hand, if it dedicated all of its resources to corn, it could produce 600 tons of corn. Now, country B. Now, country B can produce 400 tons of steel if it dedicates all of its resources to steel, or it can produce 100 tons of corn if it allocates all of its resources to the production of corn. So we're essentially looking at the endpoints of two production possibilities frontiers, basically. Now what I'm going to do here is, without any money being involved, I can look at cost, because what I've done here is I've set up all of the information to see what the opportunity costs are. And the way I'll do this here, I'm going to write the same thing two different ways for each country. And you don't have to do it this way, but if you kind of want to, you can just do sort of a monkey see, monkey do with what I'm going to do here. Look, I can, and I'm talking about country A here. It is obviously the case that 1,200 tons of steel, and I'll write that as 1,200 S, is equivalent to 600 tons of corn, which I'll write as 600 C, in terms of trade-off, one or the other. And writing that the other way, and you'll probably wonder, why the heck are you doing this? I can say 600 tons of corn is the same as 1,200 tons of steel in country A. And you're saying, well, you just wrote the same thing. Yes, I did. Yes, I did. You're right as rain. But you'll see in a minute, it's kind of a pedantic step, but it's useful. It's useful in just a moment. Now, let me take these two equations, 1,200 S equals 600 C, and I'll also do 600 C equals 1,200 S, and I'm going to reduce them, and you'll see why I'm going to do this in a minute. If 1,200 S equals 600 C, then 1 S equals 0.5 C. Do you see I just divided both sides by 1,200? Are you okay on that? Now, the reason I did that is this. I now know what the cost of a ton of steel is. It's half a ton of corn. The opportunity cost of a ton of steel is a half a ton of corn. I've actually now, I can now state steel as a base unit. One steel. What does it cost? Half a corn. Now I'm going to do it the other way. 600C equals 1200S. That would mean that one corn equals two steels. Now, you might be, if you're mathematically swift, you're saying, you just said the same thing twice. Yes, I did, and there's no real deep thing going on here. But you'll see that it makes it easier to catch the important point in a minute. Now, let me do this on the other side. Let me do this on the other side with country B. In country B, I see that 400 tons of steel equals 100 tons of corn. 400S equals 100C. Or I can write that the opposite way. 100 tons of corn equals 400 tons of steel. And again, you're probably saying, why are you doing this? Just writing the same thing twice. And I used to not do this, but believe me, this little extra step makes it so easy to see at the end. Okay, are you okay with me now? I'm just doing, basically, I'm just rewriting this stuff. Now, I'm going to, on this one, do what I did over there. I'm going to divide, take 400S equals 100C, and I'm going to divide both sides by 400. So 1S equals 0.25C. You see, I just divide both sides by 100. So now I know that in country B, one steel costs 0.25 corn. And I'm going to do it the backwards way. I'm going to divide, if 100C equals 400S, then C, dividing both sides by 100, 1C equals 4S. So in country B, one corn costs 4 steels. The opportunity cost of a ton of corn is 4 tons of steel. Now, if you were to look at the central graph, let's go back to the central graph. Country A has absolute advantage in both steel and corn. Absolute advantage simply means the country can produce absolutely more. So country A has definitely, do you see how country A has absolute advantage in steel? It can produce 1,200 tons of it. Country B can produce only a third that much, so country A is the big dog in steel. And corn, country A can produce 6 times as much corn as country B, so country A is the big dog in corn too. It has absolute advantage in both of these products, but let's look at the cost. In country A, How much does it cost to produce a corn, sir? In country A, how much does it cost to produce a corn? One steel.
Half a corn.
Half a corn. In country B, how much does it cost to produce one steel?
Quarter of a corn.
So which country can produce steel more cheaply, country A or country B?
I'm not too sure. B?
Let's try. Yes, it's B. Yes, look at it very... Don't struggle with it. You're probably trying to look at something deep in there. In country A, to make a steel costs half a corn. In country B, it costs a quarter of a corn. Country B, it's cheaper to make steel in terms of how much corn you give up. So even though country A has absolute advantage in steel, you see that, right?
Yeah.
Country B has comparative advantage. It is actually more efficient to produce steel in country B. Now let's look at it the other side. Let's look at the other side of it. And I'm going to pick on you, woman. Look at this. In country, how do you see from back here? In country A, how much does it cost to make one corn in country A?
Two steel.
And now in country B, how much does it cost to make one corn?
Four steels.
So which country makes corn more cheaply?
A.
Yes, because it costs only two steels to make a corn in A. It costs four steels to make a corn in B. So in terms of comparative advantage, country A has the comparative advantage. Mm-hmm. So if we wanted this economy, this global economy, this little tiny global economy to be at its most efficient, country A would grow the corn, country B would build the steel, and then they would trade with each other for what they needed of the other product that they didn't make. In that way, the resources of this global economy here are being used most efficiently. If we let country B move towards its comparative advantage and country A move toward its comparative advantage. Now, clearly here, it probably would not be the case that we would have pure specialization. Probably country A would suck country B dry for all of its steel. So you'd probably see country A in a real world situation doing some steel production, but it would definitely let most of that steel production be outsourced to B. And then what it would do is buy the steel from B and give B corn because B was not growing corn. It was making steel. This is how global economies work at their most efficient, is where each economy moves towards those things that it does the cheapest, the most efficiently. If we try to do everything ourselves, yes, we could do everything ourselves, but that would mean that we were wasting resources that others did not need to waste as much. Do you see how country B is a much smaller, weaker country? Well, you don't need a little weak country like that. Well, no, you don't. But if you take advantage of what they can do, you and they can both be better off because you're both using your resources more efficiently by using them on what you do the cheapest. The lesson in management here, the lesson in overall work in groups and teams, is that you might have someone who wants to do everything. Oh, I can type faster, I can do the research faster, I can do everything faster, so I'm just going to do the whole thing. That's the stupidest thing in the world, because even though that person can do everything absolutely more quickly, that doesn't mean, as a matter of fact, I guarantee you that is not going to be the most efficient use of the team's resources, of the agencies or the departments or the company's resources. If just the super hotshot who can do everything better does everything, that's a waste. That is a huge waste. You might very well be able to type much faster than other people. You might be able to do all the research for the paper much more quickly. But that would mean that you were doing everything and you were declining the advantage that is gained from people who can do some things more efficiently than you can. Just because you can do more of it doesn't mean you're doing it more efficiently. And this is the cautionary tale, is because this can be a kind of a siren call in the sense that on the one hand, we want to do everything ourselves. You know, if I can do it all, then let's do it all. Here in the United States, we can produce everything. I mean, everything. But on the other hand, simply just surrendering to a world and saying the most efficient place is where we should let everything be made, well, that has its problems too. One of them I brought up. If countries are manipulating their currencies, we are not seeing the pricing of products representing the true costs of production. No doubt about that. On the other hand, we decline a lot of opportunities for better efficiency when we don't trade with other countries. The real question, though, is, and this would be from a United States, from an American perspective, what do we do, not just more of, we can do more of everything, just about, but what do we do most efficiently, most cheaply, most effectively? And that's the question that every economy has to ask itself. Now, emerging economies, they're just like hotshot adolescents. They'll just fly and take over whatever looks like it's good to do, and they'll try to make money. In a more mature economy, we have to be contemplative. What is it we do the best? What, not just the best, the most cost effectively. We certainly can't just let the rest of the world do everything for us, and we sit in our basement eating Cheetos and playing World of Warcraft. We've got to do something. What is it we do best? And for God's sake, don't say, well, we do banking pretty well. No, we don't. So that's a complication. Now, I've actually asked classes before, what is it that we do that is more efficient? What are we best at in terms of efficiency in this world? Would it be making cars? Well, the evidence is no. Would it be building machinery? Yeah, we might actually be not too bad. There are obviously huge industrial machinery companies around the world, Mitsubishi Heavy, I mean, all these other ones in Europe and Asia. We've held our own with companies like Cat and Deere and all of those, which are still American-based, but there's some difficulties there. What is it we do best? Science? That's one place where we've done awfully well over the years. But that, of course, requires that we just keep cranking out scientists, and not just scientists who can do little things. We have to have people. How many of you are planning to take the hardcore calculus series here, the one that makes you bleed? If you are, you well. One person, the rest of you won't. We're going to lose our edge. If you take it, you know, you might actually run into me in some of those courses. It's rough. I mean, most Americans just do not want to do it. I mean, they would rather set their faces on fire and beat them out with skillets than go through hardcore calculus and differential equations and linear theory and abstract algebra and all those things you have to do to be a real scientist instead of one of these phonies that are running around claiming they're real scientists these days. What else do we do very well? What? I don't think
we do it efficiently.
Well, it's interesting though, because the U.S. has been the largest force in the world in terms of NGOs, non-government organizations that help in other countries. And for all of the talk about the evils of religion and all of that, our religious community has been a huge and enormous part of the benefit that has gone to the world over many, many years. And so have other private agencies. We do have a really bad habit of feeling bad about what a bunch of hegemonic, emperoristic brutes we are, and we do help around the world. Although we are certainly not the only countries. Médecins Sans Frontières is an enormously important organization. That's Doctors Without Borders, and that's certainly not a U.S.-based operation. But we do a lot of that. Computer technology. That's complicated because most of the hardware and a lot of software is written in other countries. However, we still have a pretty good advantage in that kind of stuff. But again, there's a lot in writing software. There's a whole lot of painful math. Are any of you planning or have taken computer programming courses here? Have you written in Java?
I'm taking C.
C? Is it easy or hard?
I'm taking this semester, so it's not easy.
If you have the sense for it, I mean, I can write in C, Java. I mean, just show me someone's code and I'll hack it, or I'll learn from it. But I mean, for a lot of people, it's just like pulling teeth out, because how in the hell do you do this kind of stuff? Here's some other things. Movies. We make awesome movies, but unfortunately, now we've got this stupid ass. Have any of you ever heard of Bollywood? Bollywood, I mean, they're beating us now. I mean, they're doing some pretty good movies. But still, we can do movies better than anyone else. Our entertainment industry is still second to none. You go to any other country, okay. Now, granted, Britain has some of the best comedies ever made, although the old ones are better than the new ones. But aside from that, though, entertainment, we have it all. We really do, in terms of, and that goes from the highest end movies on through to porn. Our porn's better than any. Have you ever seen porn that comes out of Eastern Europe? It's really sad. I mean, I've known guys who went gay trying to watch Eastern European porn. It's that bad. But our high end movies, our musicians, if you could think of musical groups that are just awesome, how many would be from other countries versus how many would be from the United States? We still rule in that. And there are good musicians. Personally, I absolutely love the group Apocalyptica. Have any of you ever heard of it? Total blank? You know Apocalyptica? I'm going to put a link on my website so that you can hear some Apocalyptica. You have never heard anything like this. You know, first you're going to look at it, you're going to say, WTF. They are really good. They're out of Finland. But as far as overall, we have the best music. We do produce the best music. I mean, can you imagine if rock and roll had been invented in China? That's just not right. It can't be. Could you imagine a Mick Jagger coming out of, let's say, Sweden? It wouldn't work. So that also, our actors and our actresses, our models. Would you prefer to see a model from, let's say, try to pick some place, from Afghanistan in Playboy magazine, or a model from the United States? And I don't mean to be sexist about that, but these are truly some of our powers, is our people are really beautiful and they're attractive around the world. People aspire to look like us, even to this day. People, kids around the world still aspire to dress like us and to act like us. I swear to God, it was the weirdest ass thing I had ever seen. French kids trying to do rap music on a street in Paris. They still admire us, even though they hate our guts for what we've been acting like the last 8 years. We are still admired. around the world. And to be honest with you, again, wasn't a big fan of Barack Obama, but the world thinks we are so cool because we can do things like this, that we can come back like this and be renewed like this. So people dress like us, they act like us, they sing like us, so we do have a strong comparative advantage. But we've got to figure out how we can live in the 21st century in a globalized economy and make a living at what we are best at. Our programming skills, our science skills, our entertainment, the look of our people, and just our attitude about everything. As much as people hate our attitude, they also admire our attitude. That kind of old, we say grace and we say ma'am, and if you don't like our style, we don't give a damn. That was the old, that song from, country song from a long time ago. So we do have advantages. And if we want to press this into service, this concept of efficiency of a global community, by moving towards comparative advantage and stepping away from absolute advantage, we certainly have to make sure that everyone plays by good rules in this, and we punish countries that don't, but we also have to define ourselves. Thank God in the United States we've been able to reinvent ourselves quite a few times over the last couple of 100 years. And so as we go into the next chapter after this, before we go into the next chapter after this one, I do encourage you to read those articles, watch those videos that I'll be putting up on the website tonight. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.